new drinks are now at McDonald's. With refreshers like the strawberry watermelon refresher and the mango pineapple refresher with popping boba. To crafted sodas like the Sprite Berry Blast with berry flavors and cold foam. Who knew ice cold drinks could be so fire? Try them all now at McDonald's.
Refreshers contain caffeine. Copyright 2026, The Coca-Cola Company. Sprite is a registered trademark of The Coca-Cola Company.
Expedia and Visit Scotland invite you to come experience the beauty that awaits in Scotland. The sweep of wild coastlines, quiet lochs, and untamed landscapes. Fresh cuisine that feels rooted in the land. Come experience the kind of stillness that stays with you long after you leave. Plan your Scottish escape today at expedia.com/visit Scotland.
Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with jazz professor, musician, and podcast host David Schroeder on the 2026 album A Kind of Gentle Life. We are honored to have David back at the show to talk about this combined world of new music and interviewing the best in jazz. Following a landmark year spent in intimate conversation with the 95-year-old icon Sonny Rollins, the families of Duke Ellington and Stan Getz, and the inner circle of David Sanborn, this NYU professor of jazz studies is distilling a lifetime of musical wisdom into a quiet revolution. The album offers a meditative dialogue on shared humanity. Its emotional core is anchored by his chromatic harmonica, bass flute, and a very interesting instrument, the Mongolian Evair Bure. It's an obscure yet hypnotic instrument that David mastered from his time performing in Ulaanbaatar. Featuring the great Italian pianist Antonio Figueroa, it's an album that shines. We get into quite a bit on our rendezvous here on Neon Jazz. Enjoy this interview.
You hanging in there? Everything's good. Yeah, I just there's always stuff going on. I am totally into talking about this album and Sonny Rollins having that interview in that time was such a titan. I can't wait to get into it. So thank you for coming back to Neon Jazz. It's great to reconvene.
Okay, man. I'm happy to be here.
So let's begin with Sonny. So what was it like? So before we get into the interview, how did you prepare? How did you go in? What were your feelings going in to talking to Sonny Rollins?
Well, I initially got this interview through a friend of mine who, as you know, I have a podcast series as well.
Yeah.
And my friend is a woman named Mary Scott, who was Ronnie Scott's widow. Ronnie Scott is the famous London impresario who created the great jazz club in Europe in 1959. And so I've gotten to know her through years. Her manager, she managed the saxophonist Tom Scott in L.A., who's a friend of mine. And anyway, I'm talking to Mary, and I said, yeah, I wish I could figure out how to interview Sonny Rollins. She goes, really? Well, I speak to Sonny just about every week. And she said, well, I'd like to, can you hook it up for me? And she called Sonny, and it took about 6 months before he decided that he would do this. And we did it over the phone because he's feeling kind of frail, so he didn't really want to go one head-to-head, which was fine. But I really didn't know how to prepare because I've been a Sonny Rollins fan. He's like one of my guys forever. And
ready to soundtrack your summer? With Red Bull Summer All Day Play, you choose a playlist that fits your summer vibe the best. Are you a festival fanatic, a deep end DJ, a road dog, or a trail mixer? Just add a song to your chosen playlist and put your summer on track. Red Bull Summer All Day Play. Red Bull gives you wings. Visit redbull.com/brightsummerahead to learn more. See you this summer.
Just to talk to him, you know, I don't know where he's coming from. I know that he scares the hell out of a lot of people. And even I have friends here, faculty at NYU Jazz, that have worked with him. And they said, well, they never spoke to Sonny when they're in the band because they were afraid of him because he's so immense. You know, he's such a large person, but it took me a minute to break the ice. But I had him on the phone for over 90 minutes.
Wow.
And I just, you know, I did my research. I read I read Aidan Levy's book on Sonny, which is really excellent and very insightful.
Yeah.
And so I just started hitting Sonny with, Sonny, when you grew up, did you know people like W.E.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson? And he's shocked that anybody knew those names, right? And he goes, oh, now we can get into this. And he just opened up. You know what? I mean, you know this. You're a great interviewer. If you capture somebody's interest, that you hit them off guard with something that they actually understand, that you know what you're talking about. You're not just like some interviewers are like, oh, where's your favorite restaurant?
When right.
You know, and it's like, if you avoid all that, you can get to the crux of the conversation. But Sonny's interview started with, he was really upset with the world and the politics and the wars and all those things. And he says, I wish I could do more. And I said, Sonny, you've done enough. I mean, you can certainly do more if you want to, but you can go to any city in the world and play Tenor Madness or any one of your songs, and people will know it. You've become an integral part of the jazz fabric and that language. So you've done it, and you continue to inspire people. And so that brought on all this other conversation, how he met Charlie Parker, and his guy was Coleman Hawkins. And, you know, it's incredible to have the opportunity. These people are still alive and
yeah.
vital.
Yeah.
And we need to celebrate them. We need to get them talking. I've been doing the same thing with two other folks that I've gotten very close with. One is Mercedes Ellington, who's Duke Ellington's granddaughter.
Yeah.
I'm interviewing her next week at the New York Public Library at Lincoln Center. We're going to premiere a movie that's been out for some time, but it's called On the Road with Duke Ellington. And it's a documentary that they followed Duke around a few years before his death. And the other person is Mike Manieri, the great vibes player,
yeah.
who's 88 and is still vital in playing.
Yeah.
And if you talk to him, he's played with Billie Holiday and Coleman Hawkins and Paul Whiteman, if you know that name, Paul yeah. Whiteman. Paul Whiteman premiered Rhapsody in Blue with George Gershwin in 1924. These people are still here,
yeah.
and they have, and they can't wait to tell their stories.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the greatest thing. I feel so blessed that I'm the guy on the East Coast that gets to finagle some of this stuff. So it's really a blast.
I love it. I feel that motor because there are so many stories they incubate. But the thing that strikes me about with Sonny is that, you know, when I talk to him, there's this motor in him where he does want to make a change and he wants to get out there. And I imagine when you live long enough and you get to that point where you literally can't, that motor is not going to go away. You're still going to be there and vital. And I remember a story that what his nephew, I'm trying to think of his name, he's in San Francisco, was telling me a story that after 9/11 happened. What's that?
Clifton Anderson?
Maybe that's it. Yeah. And this was a long time ago that we interviewed. And he told me about how after 9/11 happened, there were people, all the reporters were down there. I think it was after both the towers fell or one fell. No, it must have been after. And there was this saxophone player that was walking around playing. And the reporter goes over and says, hey, can you come over here? Can you tell me your name? And he said, I'm Sonny Rollins. And Sonny was down there playing for all the workers. And I think about what you're saying, that spirit of him that is more human than a legendary jazz musician. He just imbues this notion of like what we need to do as human beings when we're here. He's got it figured out. That's why he's so profound.
Totally. And you hear it in his music, and you hear it in his speech, and you hear it in the way that he moves, all those things. He's just a beautiful person.
Yeah, for sure. So talk to me about A Kind and Gentle Light. It seems as though it's kind of this culmination of an homage to these masters. How did this project come about? How long has it been incubating in you?
Well, this is a unique project with a friend and colleague in Rome named pianist named Antonio Figura, and we've been working together for years in various configurations. I've been traveling in Europe with him, pursuing duo concerts, and we've recorded three records together, and this is the third one. The first one was a duo, and the second one I had, as you know, one of my musical partners is Rich Shamaria, and Rich has done some just beautiful arrangements on the second one. But this one was something that I started writing all these songs during COVID, when I was actually the chair of the music department here. I was overseeing about 1,800 students and 500 faculty in COVID. So the only way I could decompress was to sit at the piano and write all this music. So, and then Antonio happened to be here at that time. So we kind of worked some things out and slowly got into the studio. But it was really an expression of, I think my publicist called it a quiet revolution, because it's not loud, it's not boisterous. If you go on to Instagram or TikTok, you see all these guys trying to copy Chris Potter playing the tenor and playing at high testosterone rates. And, you know, that there's something great about that, but there's also something great about playing beautifully and playing melodically and engaging with one or two other people. It's interesting. One of the guys I've interviewed recently was Stefan Harris, and we were talking about AI and how AI is taking over everything. And I was telling him about when I taught at the New School jazz program years ago, there was some saxophone teacher was making all of his students learn John Coltrane's Giant Steps solo. And so Stefan says, you know, that's going to be AI. It's like AI can play John Coltrane solo, but the thing that's missing is the inflection and the air and the conception of the artist as they're playing. So, you know, potentially in the end, do we want to go to the Village Vanguard, for instance, and watch a bunch of robots on stage? I don't think so.
Right.
So anyway, this record is a culmination of things that I was reading and my favorite movies that were really kind of deep. The kind of movies that at the end you kind of feel teary-eyed. And so how do you express that in music? And I think we did pretty well. The other part of this is I'm a saxophone player, but I'm not playing saxophone on this record. I'm playing other instruments that I've developed over the years, because when I became director of jazz studies at NYU, I hired all the greatest saxophone players. I hired Mark Turner and Lenny Pickett and Joe Lovano and Chris Potter and on and on. And I thought, how do I got to compete with these guys? I see they're here and they have all the gigs. And I thought, well, maybe if I learned to play like the chromatic harmonica and various flutes on this record, I'm playing the bass flute. And the really crazy instrument is the horn I brought back from Ulaanbaatar when I played with the Mongolian National Symphony, which is an instrument that kind of looks like an antelope horn. Called the Ever Beret. So all those sounds, those are the sounds that maybe AI can't copy so much because of the expression and the tone and the whatever you might melodic timbres that are created, and that with this beautifully expressive pianist Antonio Figueroa, it's just such a pleasure to put this out because it's different from everything else. And I go back, because I'm a historian, I go back to, you know, you can play a million notes, but it's funny, online, if you check out the music, that's the backdrop of many, many, many things on Instagram, and it's Dave Brubeck's Take Five. You hear that all the time, and it's like, well, wait a minute, that's an odd meter tune. That shouldn't, but there's a beauty in Paul Desmond's playing and a simplicity, and people have bonded with that. They get a certain feeling and reaction from that. So you don't really get that from playing, you know, Late Train, which I love, but it's more difficult to understand.
The one thing I think about Take Five that always warms my heart is that when Paul was on his deathbed, he gave all the proceeds of that album, that song, to the American Red Cross. It's one of the biggest contributors to the American Red Cross every year. And I think about how much that song heals on a very emotive level, but on a very real level, the fact that that's being recycled all the time into the world in wonderful ways is so cool.
This summer, serve up the Cookout Classics, Oscar Mayer hot dogs, and Heinz mustard. Grill up a dog, add classic yellow mustard, or load it Chicago style. We all know it's not a cookout without Oscar Mayer and Heinz.
Well, one more caveat to that. I interviewed John Snyder, who was Paul Desmond and Brubeck's producer and sometimes lawyer. And he says that Brubeck revealed to him that Paul actually wrote the bridge and he gave it to Dave, who wrote the A section.
Wow.
So, but Paul owns the Paul owns the copyright. He wrote the tune, but Brubeck owns the publishing, and the publishing went to the Red Cross.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, the one thing you kind of touched on with AI, which to me personally, I feel like we're going to win in the world of jazz with AI. I think there's nothing that's going to replace these hallowed institutions and these instruments and the way that all of these inflections go into it. I think it's jazz is a very specific genre that I think you can't replicate. No one's going to be hoodwinked by it. But I also find that living in America today, there's all these stressors between war and immigration and things that are making people stressed. How much of putting this album out in the world, putting these interviews out, making music, teaching the future, are you thinking about as kind of a respite, as kind of a way of being hopeful in a world right now that's increasingly getting tenuous?
Well, the music on this record, I think all the melodies are easily accessible. They're not simple melodies, but there's a beauty in the way that they've been structured with the harmony, and it's you can relax listening to this music. My wife has given some of these recordings to her yoga friends and art studio models and stuff, and they've been putting this on in those scenarios, and people seem to relax and they love it. And, you know, I kind of learned this lesson years ago. I had a record label in the late 90s, early 2000s with Kenny Werner, the great pianist, who the point of the label was to create music for wellness and meditation, because at the time people were still buying CDs on airplanes and something to listen to relax. And we thought that this was missing. And so I have this long history of trying to create melodic shapes that are inviting and calming, and combining that with the odd timbred instruments. I mean, my favorite musicians are not only saxophone players, but the great Toots Thielemans or Stevie Wonder on the harmonica, and the different sounds, some of the great classical flute players, and you know, those sounds aren't really explored too much in jazz these days. It's a lot more, from what we see here in New York, if you go to any of these jam sessions in Smalls or wherever, it's really like driven by testosterone. And it's like, well, wait a minute, there has to be something else. So I'm hoping that this is something else. And we've been getting some really great response from this. We have hopefully a small tour in Italy this summer, if airline tickets don't go out of the realm of possibility, but it's all good. It's just another document. And aside from Antonio and I on this record, I added I was introduced to a cellist named Michael Fitzpatrick, who plays very spiritually. He actually does performances with people like the Dalai Lama and Pope Francis and interesting ideas like that. And when I was right after COVID, I took a sabbatical from the university. My wife and I traveled around the world, and we ended up in Vietnam. And the two things were cool about this. Everywhere we went in the world, jazz clubs and festivals and universities, people said, "Oh, you're the guy that's had that interview series." And it's like, what? They didn't know my name, but they saw Wayne Shorter sitting next to me, I made friends easily. So when I got to Vietnam, which was a long way away, and I'm in Ho Chi Minh City, and a friend of mine hooks up some young musicians, and they see me, and they go, "Oh, it's you. It's like, we know you. We've watched all your videos." And the guy says, "We actually learned how to speak English watching your videos." So we don't know the magnitude of who's out there. I don't know who's watching the videos or the YouTube or whatever. We just don't know who we're affecting. And I think that's also the fun part. It's like, these people. So anyway, this young guitarist, because I was there, he had enough interest to figure out how to come to the U.S. And he ended up in San Francisco going to a conservatory there. So he was in town. So I had to include him on the last track. So he's a beautiful soul.
That's wonderful. That's heavy, man. That people are learning languages, and the depth of what you're doing is so profound. So, you know, I came up with a new question about 2 or 3 months ago. Joshua Redman came to Kansas City, and he was at the Folly, and I got to do a pre-concert talk with him. And I asked him, "What do you think Miles Davis would think if he came back to Earth and like really took in all of the music that's happened and what we call modern music right now? How do you think he would feel?" His answer was very unique. He said, "I'm so into what I'm doing right now, I can't even think about it." But I'm wondering, from what you as a creator of music and as an interviewer of these practitioners, what is your take on what someone like Miles would think about how the evolutionary timeline of jazz has moved into modern day?
Well, I mean, Miles is kind of a leader in moving beyond genres, right? Yeah. And it's like, well, by the time 1969 happens and In a Silent Way and Bitches Brew and all those Jack Johnson and all those things, he realized that there is an opportunity to move forward with the music. And towards the end of his life, he's playing Cyndi Lauper tunes, right?
Yeah. So
I could imagine that if he was still young and vital today, he'd be looking at pop genres and hip hop and rap and all that stuff and trying to incorporate that. Because you see him as a young man, he's a skinny guy wearing a double-breasted pinstripe suit, and towards the end of his life, he's wearing leather and fur and, you know, so he was a man of the times. Because you see the difference between him and what's his trumpet counterpart from Kansas City, from St. Louis.
I know what you're talking about.
But anyway, it's like some people became stylized, and that's what they. It's like Louis Armstrong. By 1930, yeah. Louis Armstrong had created all of the elements that made him great: his sound, his rhythm, his scat singing, his range, and he never changed from that, because Clark Terry's the name.
That's right, Clark Terry.
So they were contemporaries, but towards the end of their lives, Clark was, you know, he was a beautiful purveyor of swing and bebop, and Miles in, you know, suit and tie, Miles had moved on. So we can see that Miles would have continued to move on, and it's hard to say. I mean, you can even see that with guys like Gil Evans,
yeah,
who was a contemporary of Miles in Birth of the Cool and all that stuff. But, you know, he's like wearing long hair and an Indian headband, and his band was definitely not Birth of the Cool by the 80s.
Yeah.
And so...
Yeah, for sure.
That's the mark of people that continue to search, I think. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that's a question that my students have now, that they're saying that some of these young musicians in my program, they're saying, well, I have to play traditionally, and I have to play a bass like, you know, Paul Chambers played in the early 60s. They don't want to play like Eddie Gomez or whatever, because that's not acceptable now. And I just interviewed the great world percussionist Jamie Haddad, and he made this comment, and he says, finding your own voice is the way that you find a career, right? That's the only way you're going to make a living. You could be like a busy bee workman that sits around and waits for the phone to ring. You sit around and practice, or you can go out and create something. And so he goes into this whole thing where he wanted to be like Elvin Jones as a young man growing up in Cleveland and playing with Joe Lovano. And he got to play with people like Sonny Stitt and such. But he's been playing with Paul Simon for the last 20 years.
This NBA playoffs with FanDuel, you're not just watching the playoffs, you're a part of them.
And we're back. Steve's got the phone, opens FanDuel, locks in player points. Quick fingers, you love to see it. Now he's going for threes. Big night for Steve-O.
Be a part of the action and get better payouts this NBA playoffs on FanDuel. 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or 1-800-MY-RESET.
And it's like, that's opportunity where it happens, right? And he tells this whole story about how that was coincidence, and all of a sudden he's in. And that's what I love. It's like everybody's stories are different.
Yeah.
It's just like parents when they want to come to NYU. Well, can you tell us exactly what my child will be doing once he graduates? And I always say, you know, the reality, it's like when you've got cockroaches in your kitchen and you turn the light on and they scatter.
Yeah.
It's like that's the musician's credo, maybe. It's like nobody should go to the same place. They should just go and find a place where they can live and grow and thrive and develop.
Yeah, for sure. So I want to circle back around. I want to do full circle here. We started with Sonny. What was it like when you got off the phone? When you get off the phone with someone like him and you've had an interview with that level of energy, how do you decompress? Do you call your wife? Do you call a friend? Like, I remember I called my show engineer after I talked to Sonny, and I was just out of my head. I was like, oh my God, like the things, and just this, all of it was a lot. What do you do after seminal interviews like that?
Well, I was actually relieved, but the issue was I report...
I get that.
I was totally relieved. Oh, yes. It's done. But here's the issue with me. It's like I was using my iPhone. There's a new app on the phone. When you call somebody, you can hit record this conversation.
Yeah.
And so it's usually maybe like 5 minutes or whatever. I was on there for 90 minutes. So when I get off the phone, I'm going, where is this?
Right.
and I have the pinwheel of death.
Oh, no.
and this was it, like in the afternoon. It's like 8 o'clock at night. I have the pinwheel of death on my phone.
Oh, no.
And so I run down to the Apple store and I say, guys, what's going on? He goes, oh, gee, you know, we're still beta testing that program.
Oh, no.
But fortunately, like a day later, it showed up in my computer under my notes app.
Oh, thank God.
So now I know how to deal with it. But that he was my first attempt.
Wow.
And I, you know, it's like anytime you lose an interview, you've lost history.
It's an ice pick to the heart. It's the worst feeling in the world, because you come away and you're like, You know, I mean, there's a part of sometimes it's happened. There was a singer that I interviewed in New Orleans at one point. It was such a unique experience. I'm almost kind of happy. I wish it was documented, and I don't wish that any of that would happen, but there's sometimes that the universe has a different plan for you, but especially for Sonny. So after you get over the panic, the panacea of that almost being gone, what has been your takeaway from absorbing such a master?
Well, there was elation because he actually allowed me to engage with him. And because I had done just a little bit of research and asked him about these key figures that probably nobody talks about, W.E.B. Du Bois, right? And Paul Robeson. And then I asked him about the record Way Out West, where he's dressed up like a cowboy. And he gets into this long diatribe on how his grandmother used to take him to see all the silent cowboy movies back in the 20s, and how he liked riding horses and with his wife, and all of a sudden he's just another human being. He put his guard down, and you know what I mean. It's like when you meet great jazz musicians or great artists or great people, and they actually call you up and say, "Hey, how you doing today? What's going on?" That's the greatest prize right there, because you've connected with people. And I've been really fortunate when you actually interview folks like if you connect, you connect for a long time, and you stay connected. And when you post stuff, it's just like I posted a second part of an interview with Gil Goldstein. And I said, "Gil, I need you to do an Instagram video." And it was like 10 minutes later, and it's like, "Here you go. What else you need?" They want people to know what they do, what they've done, and people love those stories. And this goes back to years ago when I had hired John Scofield here. He used to come to my office with his cup of coffee before he'd teach, and he'd shut the door, and he'd decompress by telling me everything that happened to his travels last week on the road. And I became the lone repository for all of his stories. And I said, this can't be how this ends. It's like these stories have to live forever and for because it's the histories that change, that make the music more important.
Absolutely.
Like the way that these people have come up and grown and understand things. It's like understanding Wayne Shorter by understanding that he loves sci-fi and motion pictures. And when I interviewed him, by the end of the interview, he's doing his Charles Laughton impersonation and his Humphrey Bogart impersonation. And that's where his heart is. You don't sit around and talk about chord changes. It's gone way beyond that.
Yeah, it's the human depth. So I'm curious, you get the chance to interview all of these luminaries and these musicians. Is it odd for you to be interviewed? Does it still seem strange? Or is it just a part of the entire ecosystem of what you do on a regular basis?
Well, it's fun to tell my stories. I don't get to just people see me as that other guy, but I've learned, as you've learned, it's like as I'm talking, you're probably thinking, "All right, what's my next question?" Right? So you're always moving ahead. You're nodding your head like you're listening to me. This is my thing too. It's like I'm nodding, yes, but I'm thinking, okay, where's this leading to? And it's like, I will tell you the probably the strangest interview was the John Coltrane movie came out, The Chasing Train, and there was a scene where they're in Japan, and there's the greatest jazz collector library of John Coltrane's memorabilia, right? And this guy Fuji is spent his life building this. So I run into Fuji on the street through somebody, and they say, "Hey, Fuji, I'd love to interview you. Would you come in front of my students with a three-camera shoot?" And you go, "Oh, yeah." So So I'm spending all this time and energy and money on producing this video with Fuji. And I say, so Fuji, what period of John Coltrane's music inspired you to spend your whole life building this library of collectibles? And he says, well, I don't actually listen to John Coltrane. I just like collecting things.
Pool days call for cookouts and lots of laundry. This Memorial Day at Lowe's, save $80 on a Charbroil Performance Series 4-burner gas grill. Now just $199. Plus, get up to 45% off select major appliances to keep dishes, clothes, and food fresh. Having fun in the sun is easy with us in your corner. Our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Valid through 5/27. While supplies last, selection varies by location. See associate or Lowe's.com for details.
And he, and he says, you know, at the time, I was trying to decide whether to collect Coltrane or the Beatles.
Wow.
And it's like, okay, what's the, so now, what's the next question? What's the next question?
They just jammed the radar with that one. Wow.
Oh my gosh. And that was hard after that.
Wow, I bet. That's great. I, you know what that makes me think of? I just interviewed for the second time Brian Haas from Jacob Fred. And I always remember the first time I interviewed him. It was early on when I started. And he said, I'm not a religious man, but I listen to John Coltrane every day. And I will never forget that quote. Just every day. And I reiterated it to him recently. And he was like, oh, yeah, every single day Coltrane's happens at some point, which is beautiful. So, yeah, it's a spiritual thing. For sure.
Yeah, he's not leaving. You know, what's really interesting with that is especially the spiritual part is I interviewed a guy named John O'Gallagher that I knew from years and years and years ago. And he spent 10 years transcribing John Coltrane's late period, like Interstellar Space and Stellar Regions, which most people would say is free jazz.
Yeah. Right?
It turns out that Coltrane continued to study with a guy named Dennis Sandoli in Philadelphia ever since he got out of the Navy. And by this time, Coltrane was now incorporating 20th century serial techniques into his music. So it turns out that he's not playing free. He's actually using all these Schoenberg and Webern processes to create his improvisations.
Wow.
And that is so heavy.
Yeah. That's
and then crazy. If you hear John play, you hear it.
Yeah.
You hear that late stuff, and it's like, what's Train playing? Is he just gone, he's taken Ornette Coleman and moved into free jazz, and it's not true. So
right.
It shows that the creative mind, his mind, I can't imagine, you know, after he had done all of his Coltrane Matrix and Sheets of Sound, that he would actually just give it all up and play free. So
yeah.
So it turns out that that's not the case.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, David, the new album of Kind of Gentle Light is out in the world. It's a wonderful album. It's so great to catch up with you again. Thank you for the music. Thank you for the work you're doing. It's always an honor. Thank you so much.
Well, we'll see you again, Joe, and hopefully you'll come to New York one of these days.
You're going to be the first person I'll call, absolutely.
And I'll interview you. How about that?
I love it.
Thanks for listening and tuning into another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players and minds in New York City, Kansas City, and spots all over the globe, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to David for coming on by the show. It's always a profound honor. If you want to hear more Neon Jazz interviews, you can find us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Subscribe to us at YouTube, and for everything Neon Jazz, go to the neonjazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.